I'm on my way from UCSB to Leiden, so I stop in Toronto, and I will explain why I have two positions. It's for one particular experiment that I'm very keen on to realize, and it needs expertise from both places, and it needed funding from people interested in fundamental research. So in the US, it was a bit tricky to get the right amount of funding, so I applied in Europe, and they gave me right away. So that's how this situation started. I suppose this is the pointer. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's quite unique, yes. Good. Questions? Good. There are a few topics that I'm equally intense working on, and there are four topics, but three I want to discuss today: solid-state cavity QED, and an experiment towards microscopic quantum superpositions, and theory work on knots of light that hopefully become experiments in the near future. So let's start with the first part, which is for mainly theorist audience a bit experimental, so we'll keep it brief. So it's based on using electron spins as qubits, and the question is, how can you play with electron spins inside the solid state? And my background in quantum optics tells me that I should try to interact these electron spins with photons as good as I can and take it from there. So when I came to UCSB, that is the type of collaboration I set it up. I wanted to create a direct link between single photons and the spin of single electrons. So the road that we started out with the colleagues at UCSB, in particular Pierre Petrov and Larry Colton in the engineering department, is to use self-assembled quantum dots. And those are semiconductor materials, a large bandgap material, surrounding a small blob of a small bandgap material. So you get the conduction band looking like this, where this would be the quantum dots, and the valence band looking like this. So you basically have confined electronic states and confined Hall states. And for these materials, you typically have two lowest electronic states, the plus minus spin a half, and the highest, or the highest valence band states are Hall states of minus 3/2 and plus 3/2. And there are two recombinations that gives you spin one particles photons with left and right-handed polarized light. Now, if you include in the materials, in the growth of your material, electrical gates, you can actually tune a quantum dot to go from a neutral, so there are no extra electrons, to one extra electron, two extra electrons, three, or one extra hole. So you can control the charging of an individual quantum dot. And this is just, I don't want to go into detail here, but this is an idea how to use electron spins coupled to photons. Why would that be useful? So we would have two quantum dots, quantum dot one and quantum dot two. And the qubit will be the spin of a single electron, right? So that's represented by those two states. And if you would be able to entangle the spin of a single electron with the state of a single photon that is coming out of the structure. So if you can create a state that looks like this, where the second indices represents the two orthogonal states of photons, say left-handed and right-handed polarized light, if you're able to realize that, you can do that on two sides, and then your total, your product state it has this form, and then you can play all kind of optics tricks on the photons. For example, you could design an apparatus that projects out the two photons onto this state. And as a result of that projection with this extra minus sign, the two electron spins are projected out onto that state. So in a sense, you teleport a two-qubit gate. Yeah? So this is the phase gate where you get only a minus sign if both initial electron spins are down. So if you can entangle a photon with the state of an individual spin, and you do that in two places, if you can extract that photon efficiently, then you can do your standard optics tricks to do quantum computation, and you could build up cluster states of many of these electron spins. Yes?
The first two components
feet cubed, where you have the up and down arrows, those represent the spin of the electron.
Yes, spin of half and spin minus half of an electron spin in a quantum dot.
And then the next two components, where you use 0 and 1, those are the polarization of the photon?
Yes, they would be, if you somehow can get the photon out that is entangled with the state of this electron spin, then you can start your hybrid quantum processing schemes by doing all your manipulations only on the photons. So that's
the 0, 1, 1 refers to the polarization of the photon.
Yes. So this is the part, if you can realize that in an efficient way, then all these schemes become possible. But that seems like a very challenging project to have a single electron spin becoming entangled with a single photon that is leaving your structure in a well-defined way. I should mention that there are similar experiments that people try to do with ion traps, where you have two ion traps in a setup like this, and then you collect photons that are then entangled with the state of the ions. And you can actually do operations, two qubit operations, with a fidelity of 0.8, and that can be improved by better optics. But the difficulty is that the probability of success is extremely small, because it's very hard to extract this one photon that is coupled to your structure, to extract that in such a way that it couples nicely to a specific optical mode. So that is the problem that people in ion and atom traps are struggling with, and that will stay a bottleneck for a long, long time. And in solid state, you don't have to worry about your trapping fields. You can build everything in principle in a single device and have a very good coupling to an optical mode. Well, let's see how far we can get with that. So we want to have an electron spin coupled to photons using micropillars. There are different type of cavities that we use, but here I focus on the micropillars. Typically, people take a Bragg mirror. Then there is a layer where the quantum dots are in, and then there's another Bragg mirror, and then you etch down these thin pillars to get a very small mode volume cavity. Because if you have a very small mode volume cavity, you have what is called cavity QED, you have Purcell effect, you have enhancement of spontaneous emission into that specific cavity mode. You could see that as follows, spontaneous emission can be seen as stimulated emission by the vacuum fluctuations. And there's a half h bar omega of energy in the vacuum fluctuations. So if that mode in which you have your vacuum fluctuation is confined to a very small volume, you have a stronger coupling to that one specific mode. So your spontaneous emission into that cavity mode is hugely enhanced, and the emission into any other modes is hugely suppressed. So we want to use that feature. But the problem is, technically, if you make these edges down, you get the optical modes start scattering from these cyclones. And that limits the Qs of about to about 1,000, which is reasonable, but not that great. So the first step in our design was to go to much thicker pillars, much bigger, but have a layer in there that we can oxidize afterwards. After the pillar is made, you can oxidize. And this is half of the pillar in cross-section. And you get your optical mode confined in this part, and you don't have any trouble with cyclone scattering. So with those structures, we get about 50,000 round trips in such a cavity. So we get a huge improvement of the cavity. Now, this method of oxidation-determined cavities also allows us to make structures like this. This is a top view. You etch down. The oxidation goes inwards, still defining a tiny microcavity in the center. But now all your layers, all the material is still connected to the outside. So that means that we can have electrically doped layers inside the material and make gates, electrical gates, on the outside and contact, and thereby be able to apply voltage over the quantum dots that are in the cavity. Yeah, that's a difficult task to do on structures like that. You cannot just contact, electrical contact, these structures. So actually nobody did that before. So with those structures, we can now actually charge the quantum dots and control star shifting.
And have you made that demonstration?
Yes, it's here. So this is, if we do a measurement on the bulk material, so where we don't look at the cavity, but it's sandwiched between Bragg mirrors, then you see that if I change the voltage across the structure, I can go from the neutral state where there are no extra electrons. At a certain point, you really add an extra electron to your structure, and that works nicely. And the hard part was to make this work inside the cavity as well, because your electrical contacts in these regions are difficult to make. But let's first analyze the region outside. How do I characterize, apart from this plot, how do we characterize that we have the neutral or the charged state? Well, you can look at the lifetime, the emission lifetime of the photons coming out of the structure once you excite them. And you will see two type of curves, one with a single exponential decay of a few nanoseconds, and one with a double exponential decay. And the reason for this double exponential decay is that in the neutral state, if you create electron hole pairs at higher energies, these electrons are captured in the quantum dot. But by the time they're captured, the electrons or the hole spin could have changed. So you might not have a spin one or a spin minus one state, but a spin two or plus two state. And therefore, you have to wait till either the electron or the hole flips before you get your optical recombination. You have to go back to a spin one situation. Yeah. So the neutral state could be in the dark state, and you have to wait till it gets to the bright state. And this is the typical timescale for the dark state to flip to the bright state. If you go to the singly charged state, you have already one spin, one electron spin in your quantum dot. If you add an electron hole pair, you have the two spins automatically with opposite spins, and you always have the right electron to recombine with whatever hole state you have. So in that case, you only get a single exponential. Okay? And your device becomes a very clean single photon source. You really get, we get world record single photon sources as we're publishing here. So this is the characteristic feature from going from a neutral to a charged state. And if we now go to this device where we measure from the cavity, what we see, we cannot make this plot because the cavity mode will give you a huge signal on top of that at the resonance. So that's why we have to have a secondary way of measuring what is a charged state and what is a neutral state. So now we look at the lifetimes, and you see that we still have, in the regime where we have the neutral state, we have this double exponential. If we have the singly charged state, we have this nice slope. And also note that the slope is much steeper because of the Purcell enhancement, the cavity enhancement emission in that mode. And here we become almost resolution limited by the device. Okay, so we have controlled charging inside these micropillars. That's the next step. If you pump above the band gap, you create electron hole pairs, but by the time they're captured, you lose the properties. So we have to pump on resonance. So that is the next step. We take a resonance laser beam and start scanning over the surface of these devices until we hit the cavity mode. At that point, it becomes a Fabry-Perot where the light simply goes through the structure if there's no absorb. Right? So if you pump resonantly, you would see, so if we change the frequency of the narrow line with laser, we tune it over resonance, and there's no quantum dot in the structure, we see a dip that goes almost to zero. And now if you have a quantum dot that could absorb that light, then basically you have a bad cavity because you have an absorber inside your cavity. But if you have a bad cavity, you basically start reflecting the light from the top mirror. So it's quite an interesting effect that by looking at the reflection at this point, you can in principle tell whether there is a quantum dot in it or not. Yeah? So this is by far the highest resolution measurement of a single quantum dot by using the cavity and scanning over it. And here you see we have a single electron in the structure, and we can tune over the resonance. Now, if you put the parameters in, that this device operates deep in the Purcell regime, just before the onset of strong coupling. Strong coupling would mean that you absorb a photon, it re-emits, it reabsorbs, but we don't want that. We want the photon to couple to the electron or to the quantum dot, but not in a reversible way. We don't want it to oscillate in there. So this is precisely the reason, the region where we want to be in. We have different devices where we are just about in the strong coupling regime, so we are on the X. But the most important thing is that we get a mode matching of almost 100%. So that means that we are at the single photon level communicating with these micropillars. Yeah. Now, this measurement will appear soon in PRL, was not yet for a polarization degenerate cavity. It's difficult. We must have these cavities polarization degenerate. And this oxidation makes the cavity slightly elliptical. And there are different reasons why the cavity would have a splitting for different polarizations. So by changing the orientation just on the sample, we can actually play with the detuning of the two lines. And we have samples where we have very nice degenerate cavity modes with 50,000. The problem was that that specific sample, we didn't have the electric contact yet. So putting that all together, having polarization degeneracy plus electric contact, is what we're doing right now. And the measurement that we need to do at that point, once we have such a device, which should be perfectly possible, is to put your laser on resonance with a certain polarization. And then if the photon reflects, you know the spin was up. If the photon is transmitted, we know the spin was down. So the structure looks like this. We have our micropillar. We would have a quantum state like this of the electron spin. And after that, you would have entangled the electron spin with the transmission and reflection in a very efficient way. So you basically have a single photon interaction-free single electron spin measurement. And the good thing about these structures is, that's another project that we're working on, that we can, instead of external modes, we can glue them to fibers and actually have many of them in just a beaker of helium and do all your measurements on photons. So I think this is close to a working elementary block for single electron spin, single photon quantum processing. Okay. So that's about that part. Any questions here? Yes?
What was the efficiency with which it's reflecting?
The efficiency of coupling a single photon to this structure was 96%. Mm-hmm. And that means that the signal will be transmitted either with, well, the photon will come out here or there with maybe 92% or something. And with that quality, it's entangled with the electron spin. Yeah. Whereas for the ion traps, it's 10 to the minus 4, roughly, squared for two sets. So they can never scale up to 3 or 4 parts. And so you really have to go close to unity to do something interesting with these hybrid schemes.
Do you get 96% deterministic with every device, or is this just a good device?
We have them on several devices. And I should show a few things on the photonic crystals, because we're using techniques that we learned there. There are different types of cavities, photonic crystals. We can make them in all kinds of shapes. You can analyze them. And there, the mode form is even smaller. And you have to predetermine where a quantum dot is, and then place the crystals around it. And that technique, we developed an optical technique. And we can, with 5 nanometer accuracy, determine where to place the photonic crystals. And we see strong coupling in 7 out of the 10 devices. This is not yet published. It will be published soon. But we have to use that technique also for the micropillars. And then we can pre-select pillars that have quantum dots at the same frequencies. And then we can put 2 or 3 and couple them by optics. So that technique is available, and we're right now developing that. Any more questions on this part? Then we go to something completely different, but it's still the obvious. Obviously, the previous project is entirely based on the engineering, solid state, nanofabrication facilities at UCSB, and it's quite exceptional what can be done there. And I wouldn't have dreamed of being able to do these experiments before going to UCSB. Okay.
One last question for you.
Yes.
In answer to Richard's question, you said you wanted to entangle the spin with the polarization degree of freedom.
Yes. Well, actually, in this case, you're right. It's the you entangle in the transmission frequency, reflected or transmitted, but an important aspect of it is the polarization of it. So you need to have the modes polarization degenerate. Yes. And then, of course, if you have them in two modes, you can always put them together in one mode and have it encoded in polarization. That's just a change of phases. Okay. Towards quantum superpositions of a tiny mirror. This is a project that's going on for quite some time in my group. And let's start with some old-fashioned quantum mechanics. What is the wave function? And if anyone can tell me, please let me know. But according to Bohr, we shouldn't attach too much physical reality to it, but regard it merely as referring to our knowledge of the system. Now, that interpretation needs quite some rethinking, and right, especially in combination with the measurement postulate, where the only thing you can extract from your complex components are the probabilities for measurements. And then you could ask, but in which basis are you measuring? And at least that part is well understood, that if systems become macroscopic, there are certain states that are preferred due to the interaction with the environment. So environmental induced decoherence is quite well understood and tells us which states are likely to be observed in an experiment on a macroscopic object. It doesn't explain why you get one particular outcome. It just explains that the correlations between the different outcomes are such that you cannot do any interference experiments anymore. Yeah. So it doesn't take away any magic about the wave function describing different realities, if you wish. So the opposite spectrum of interpretations of the wave function is we shouldn't be too stiff in our thinking and just, if that's the wave function, then, and it describes the physics, so we should give some physical reality to it, okay? And that goes under the name of many worlds interpretation, and there are many people who strongly support this. I think the first person that came up with it is Everett, who wisely after his PhD went into finance, right? But if I ask some more serious colleagues of mine at UCSB, like Jim Hartle, who wrote books on general relativity, he said, well, of course, we live in a many worlds interpretation or in a many worlds situation because the universe is described at some point, must be described by one wave function, and nobody's doing measurements on that. So we assume nobody's doing measurements on that. So there's no way you could have any projections taking place. Of course, locally, we might, by our measurements, simulate sort of projections, but the full coherence is still preserved, even if it's distributed over the environment. So then we're back almost to Schrödinger's cat, or if you wish, Feynman's watch. I met Feynman on a way to some Chevy conference in China some time ago, and he was very frustrated because he applied for a patent here. And he was frustrated that it didn't get through. So I told him, what is this then all about? He said, well, I basically want to have a type of watch with a single photon source, a beam split, and two detectors, single photon detectors. So I know quantum mechanically after this beam split, you have a superposition of the photon being there and there. And quantum mechanics simply tells us that this detector clicks and that detector clicks in such a way that I can never do an interference experiment to confirm that they click at the same time, but they do, according to quantum mechanics. So that's the cleanest way where you see the many worlds interpretation. So he was convinced that if you have a difficult question in life to make, just ask your watch and just do what it tells you. And if it goes wrong, at least you have peace of mind that there is another world that it goes right. And he's quite convinced that at some point there will be people interested in buying such a thing. Okay, so
where did you get the image?
This watch is probably some expensive Swiss watch, but or you mean that image? That's
no.
Okay. So Roger Penrose says, "Well, oh, wait a minute. This is going all way too crazy. We don't understand quantum mechanics. We don't understand general relativity. Let's not make hasty conclusions about ridiculous many worlds. So Penrose says, well, before we go any further, let's think a little bit more what we mean by superpositions of macroscopic objects. And he says there's an intrinsic conflict between putting a mess in two places and describing it quantum mechanically, right? And so one way to see that is if the object, the massive object, is in one place, you can solve Schrödinger's equation, you get your eigenstates, and they are eigenstates of the time derivative operator. And if the object is in another place, you have a different equation to solve, where this time is actually a different operator. You have a different space-time structure, and you're not allowed to say that this time is the same as that time. So how can we talk about a superposition? What does it mean? Which time frame do we use? Or in a picture, if a massive object is here, you have your curvature of space-time around here. If it's at a different place, you have a different space-time structure. So you should not write down a wave function of x, y, z, and t to describe the superposition. And that's what everyone does when you describe a superposition of a photon, of an atom, of an ion. You never take into account that you should be careful by using x, y, z, and t as a given coordinate system. Okay, so I think this is pointing out a valid issue. The question is, what do you do with it? And the next step that Penrose does is, he says, well, let's consider we have this superposition of two space-time structures corresponding to the two parts. And then in each part, you can write down your classical gravitational fields. And I simply take the difference in these gravitational fields. So you basically take sort of this quantity. It has to be something positive. So I take it squared, and I integrate it over the whole space. And dimensional, this will end up with a term that is a certain energy. Yeah. So that's basically all he does. He says, if I have this blister in space-time, there is a certain amount of energy associated with that. And that step is a delicate part, whether you agree or not. But you can clearly calculate that amount, and then use this quantum mechanics again and says, well, if you want this superposition to exist, you need to have an uncertainty in energy of this size, and therefore you can have it for a certain amount of time given by the uncertainty relation. So the more massive your object gets, the larger this term, the smaller the time scale that your superposition can exist. Then you can calculate what it does if you take an atom in a superposition. Then delta t becomes of the order of millions of years. So you can do superposition experiments with atoms without ever worrying about different space-time structures. Yes.
So I like the idea that there is a difference in the gravitational field between the two. But where I'm getting lost is a difference in gravitational energy. Which one has the higher energy, the white or the red?
No, there's no, there, to have both at the same time, the argument is that you need to have extra energy in the structure. There's a difference between the two states, and if they're both at the same time, this would imply that you have the difference in energy between the two states added to your space-time structure.
But if there's a difference in energy between the two states, then one state must have a higher energy than the other one.
No, it's not that the two states have the same energy.
Right.
But the issue is that the notion of time in the two states is different. Say, the question is the object on the bottom is trying to decide where to fall to. And so it's following some Schrodinger equation, but should it use a d by dt? Mm-hmm. With respect to the first, I'm just repeating what you said. With respect to the first mass or d by dt, with respect to the second mass, it's confused.
Right.
And the amount of confusion, a different way to go through the argument is to sort of ask, you know, by how much delta t is there a confusion, because that should result in some decoherence and some loss of superposition.
So I understand the idea of delta t, but what's written down here is delta e.
Right.
I don't understand
the delta e is a shortcut to get to that delta t. The delta t you could work out through general relativity is h bar over that delta e.
Okay, so there is no energy difference. The physical thing is a delta T, and delta E is just a way of representing that?
No. Well, that's the way I think of it. I don't know if you think of it differently. It comes to the same thing.
The state, the superposition state is one state. And that state requires a certain amount of extra energy compared to the states individually. So if it's here or there, they would have the same energy. But if they're both at the same time, that state has this additional amount of energy. And what Penrose doesn't explain is that it reduces to one or the other. It just tells you it doesn't like to be in a superposition for a certain amount of time. So the superposition state itself that you force by an experiment, you force onto your system, that state has a higher energy than a state where it's going to one or the other.
So does a negative superposition, if you could have a, you know, left or white plus red, you could also have white minus red. Does that have a lower energy?
No. It would have the same energy. Yes.
So these can't be energy eigenstates, right? Because distinct energy eigenstates with non-zero overlap. So is it this expected energy?
Okay. I think these detailed questions are not answered, and I think we should discuss them maybe a little later. Again, if you talk about to Penrose, there are many things you could bring up. For example, if you take an electron in a superposition, you never calculate its electrostatic interaction with itself being at this place or at that place. And here you sort of do that with the mass. So there, you must also have an argument why superpositions in space are completely different than superpositions in charge or other properties.
This is a heuristic argument. It's not a theory, it's a heuristic argument.
Yes.
Based on the idea that quantum mechanics, the linearity of quantum mechanics must break down when you don't know who d by dt is, because d by dt is determined by where the masses are.
That's right.
And so it's a kind of order of magnitude estimate of where you expect to see decoherence as a result of that.
Okay, I think I should move on. So this is back in 2001 in Oxford. So I first was a postdoc with Penrose and then went to Innsbruck and then came back to the physics department, and Richard Penrose actually just knocked on the door in the laboratory and came in and said, well, I have this idea and I want to talk to you about an optical experiment. He wanted to test his gravitational decoherence model by doing an experiment in space. He said, I know all the right people at NASA, and so let's see if we can do that. And then I said, wait a minute, before you launch anything or whatever, it will take 20 years. So let's think about an experiment on an optical table. So as a result of that, we wrote a paper where the idea is to simply take a single photon. We put it in a superposition, and the photon goes either in a cavity, a rigid cavity, or a cavity with a tiny mirror that could move. And the idea is that if you can make this mirror light enough, the cantilever smooth enough, the mirror's high enough quality, then if the photon bounces around here, you would displace this mirror by more than its ground state wave packet, and you would entangle the position of the photon, either here or there, with the motion of that mirror. So in that way, you could get a massive superposition. This mirror would have about 10 to the 14 atoms. It would be about 9 to 10 orders more massive than any quantum experiment done today. And our first goal, theoretically, was to actually see whether the parameters are right to show a superposition. And what does it take to show that superposition for certain massive objects? And then where Penrose wants to be is another 2 or 3 orders more massive than what we propose in this paper. So but let's first have a look at that. The model is quite straightforward. You have a quantum mechanical description of this harmonic oscillator that holds the mirror, and you have your photons in your photon number state, and you have the coupling of the number of photons with the position of your harmonic oscillator. So you can solve this model, and there are several papers on that. And you have to think a little bit, what state is your mirror in? Well, it's in some sort of coherent state over thermal distribution. Then the initial state of your photon, here I represent the photon being in a superposition of not being in arm A but being in arm one plus the opposite, right? So this would be the initial superposition of your photon. This is your initial state of the mirror. And then if this state acts on the mirror, you will displace it. If this one is, it will not change. And then you can calculate how this entanglement evolves under this Hamiltonian that I gave as function of time. And then you will see that you get an entangled state of the mirror and the photon, except after one period of oscillation. Because if you, it's come handy now. This is your mirror. You start out in this situation, the photon comes in. Once the photon is in the cavity, it bounces around 10 to the 6 times, if possible. And that can be calculated as a continuous force. So you basically start out of equilibrium state for the situation with the force, because this would be the equilibrium state with force. So because of the optical force, it will oscillate around the equilibrium place. And if the photon leaks out of the cavity after one period of oscillation, the cantilever was at the point that it wanted to go back, so it's actually at rest. So at that moment, if the photon leaves out, you're back exactly in the same place, and you erase whether the photon took this path or the other path. So what you expect to see if you do all your measurements on the photons, you would expect to see interference fall down as function of the size of the cantilever. But after one period, you should get your interference back because you erase the information which path the photon took. And now, of course, the hardest part is to prevent decoherence by the time you have one period of oscillation. And also, your relative data will be in a small interval. And that depends extremely on the temperature of your cantilever. Because if you start out with a thermal distribution of states of your cantilever, you have to have all the phases have to line up exactly, and you will have a much harder time to get this revival method. So if you could start almost in the ground state, you just get a cosine function. So the lower the temperature, the more clear you could measure this in a convenient way. So here, just put some numbers, say 60 microkelvin, then you have about a 1% window to see this revival. I'm not quite sure yet.
Yeah. That doesn't look bounded below.
It doesn't.
Doesn't look as though it's bounded below.
It doesn't look it's bounded below.
And I guess B must be diagonal to the sun.
Okay.
Is this some kind of an approximation that you can only?
Yes, this is definitely in the linear regime of the harmonic oscillator.
That depends how long you can use it. If you go for too long, then it will oscillate.
Okay.
Okay, then I guess.
I have to look back at that. This is quite the standard Hamiltonian that several papers start out with. But there are several assumptions involved in modeling it in this way. So you say that might not be bounded from below, but if there are no phonons and no photons, wouldn't that be the ground state?
So I'm guessing AWA is a positive operator.
Mm-hmm. So but that can
positive, then.
Right. I see what you mean. Yes. But if this one is larger, this one will be larger. Well, it depends on the relative vectors. Yeah. Okay. But at least this type of phenomena is to be expected intuitively. And you can calculate what requirements you would have to actually displace this tiny mirror, if you could make it, by more than a ground state wave packet. And the parameters that we found were surprisingly within range of a real experiment. You would need a mirror of about 10 microns in diameter. You would need 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 round trips, a length of 1 to 5 centimeters, and a resonance frequency of a few kilohertz. So this is not yet to observe gravitation-induced decoherence. This would be an experiment that would bring you to quantum superpositions of an object about 8 orders more massive than anything observed in a quantum superposition. Then you have to calculate the standard environmental induced decoherence, and that scales with the displacement squared. And with the quality factor of your cantilever, which sets the coupling to your environment, the coupling is through the cantilever. And then if we take quality factors of 10 to the fifth, which are reasonable at a few millikelvin, we come to a temperature of a few millikelvin, and that is the bulk temperature. So there are two temperatures in the problem. The temperature of the harmonic motion of the filamental mode of this cantilever, that has to be extremely low, that temperature, in order to see the revival. On top of that, the bulk temperature, all the modes in the system, must be well below a few millikelvin in order to have a revival at all after one period of oscillation. So there are two temperature regimes that come into play. And then there are stability requirements and the number of background particles. There should be no collision at all with the cantilever, with any background particle. But that is taken care of automatically if you work at extremely low temperatures, because the cold walls trap all the particles. The stability is going to be the hardest part. Okay. So now we went as bold as actually starting out experiments. And this is an atomic force microscope. And we can, with some special techniques, we can actually fabricate and cut out. This is a Bragg mirror. I know people have to go to some faculty meeting, so feel free to go. So this tiny mirror then has to be positioned onto this cantilever, and then you have to build a cavity out of it. And you would think that a small cavity would never give you a high-quality cavity mode, but people typically talk in terms of Gaussian beams. And then, of course, you would have a lot of scattering from the cycles of the mirror, but you have to use completely different beams that actually have sharp edges at the edge of your mirror, and then you can calculate that you could have very high-quality mirrors. We only get a few thousand at the moment with those first tries, but we can make a nice cavity out of it, and we can tune it, and we can do some optical cooling with it. So, as I said, we need to have a standard temperature that is well below a few millikelvin. And there are different ways of getting there. But in addition, we need this fundamental mode of the cantilever. We need to have that as low as possible. And for that, we want to use optical cooling. And that works very simple in principle. You basically measure interferometrically the motion by being on the edge of a resonance. On the resonance of a slope, you can measure the motion and then feed back the intensity of this laser beam so that you counteract the motion that you measure, and thereby you damp the one specific mode that you're looking at. And we did that starting from room temperature, and we could cool down about three orders of magnitude. And in principle, that method should work also if we start at lower temperatures. So the next step of the experiment is, let's try to reproduce this starting from as low as possible temperature you can get. And that brings me to Leiden, which has a special measurement hole for low temperature physics. You need extremely good isolation preparation. You need a machine shop that knows the properties of all the materials, how they interact at low temperatures. So, and that's where this European grant came in. So this is the design of the setup. It is on some concrete post. There are some 30 meter posts into the ground. And this is a huge dilution refrigerator. And then this is the bottom of the dilution refrigerator, which should get us at 10 millikelvin. From that, you have a very pure copper block with thin slits. And if you apply this with a superconducting magnet at 10 Tesla fields, you align the nuclear spins. If you then slowly reduce the magnetic field, you basically absorb energy by reorienting the nuclear spins. Thereby, this copper block would cool down to about 100 microkelvin. And then with 100 microkelvin, we will couple to our cantilever, which will then be optically cooled in this structure. OK? So where are we? This was this design is 2 years ago. This is the bottom of the dilution refrigerator, which we have at 3 millikelvin by now, which could only be done in Leiden in this short amount of time. It would have cost me 5 years at least at UCSB. This is Giorgio Fossati, who actually had the world record for low temperatures for many years and now has a company in dilution refrigerators and sells 50% of all systems in the world. So he is partly involved in this project. In return, I'm partly involved in his project on gravitational wave detectors with a copper sphere of this size that he cools down to 60 millikelvin to measure small vibrations, which is the setup that is right next to here, but I don't have time to discuss that. So here you see the mounting of the copper block. And as I speak, this is being tested right now. We had a previous test where it turns out that it was cooling fine, but the thermometer, which is almost as difficult as this, gave up at just below 1 millikelvin. So we don't know how cold it got last measurement, but it is working. And this is the optic setup that is currently being tested at an 80 Kelvin system, because we cannot just cool down every time. It takes a few thousand dollars to actually get to low temperatures. So we have another system where we can test the optics, whether it survives the low temperatures and whether the vibrations are proper bent. Then at UCSB, we have a large effort in making much better mirrors on much thinner and sensitive cantilevers, because atomic force cantilevers are way too crude for the final experiment, and the mirror quality wasn't good enough. We have to deposit the mirrors ourselves. And we're lucky that Intel gave up one of their optics divisions, in which they had one of four best optical coating machines in the world, and they donated one to UCSB. Unfortunately, they took out the hardware because they had some secret recipes on there, but the hardware also controls the growth process. So we had a 1 year delay before we could actually start growing the mirrors ourselves. But that's these mirrors are now developed and we're testing them. So it's almost ready to be pulled together. I think we get the low temperature, we know how to do the optical cooling. The main worry are vibrations at the moment. So that's what I hear tomorrow or Friday, what the latest is on that. We're building some internal vibration systems, also using some superconducting coils with them. Okay. So that was the second project. And I have another 5 minutes maybe to explain a third hobby, I would say. This has been something going on also for about 8 years now, and comes back to my time as a postdoc with Roger Penrose working on twister theory, where very special solutions of Maxwell's equations show up. And I was pointed out by Michael Berry that there was a French guy, Professor Ranjada, who discussed lots of light in a completely different context. He wanted to find confined optical structures and give that as the reason for quantization of light. He was looking for a classical mechanism for quantization. And he came up with some very interesting solutions of Maxwell's equations, but it didn't work out. It didn't give the right numbers, so he lost interest. And he applied it to explain something completely different. So we started looking at those solutions. It's a paper 20 years ago. I think there are three references to it all by himself. So it's a completely obscure paper that, but I think has some very beautiful physics in there. So we revisited that work and extended it and showed that there are proper solutions of light, and we might actually be able to make them in an experiment. And what you could do with it could be quite spectacular. So let's first show the few things that we need. We need to understand what stereographic projections are, so I don't have to explain it to you. So S2 can be projected on R2 plus a point at infinite. So C combined with infinite. You could do the same with S3. We would need that. You could stereographic project S3 onto R3 with a point at infinite. The north point is basically projected out on the whole point at infinite. Yeah. And you have the same stereographic projection from S3 to R3. So our S3 would be represented in four dimensions by this sphere. And you could go to the components in R3, x, y, z, or you could do the inverse, right? So that's one basic ingredient. The second basic ingredient is the Hopf map. And there are different Hopf maps, but we consider the Hopf map from S3 to S2. And I cannot draw S3, But I can draw the projection on R3. So this is the stereographic projected image of S3. S2 I can draw. And the point now is that circles on S3, on the surface of S3, which is a three-dimensional surface, circles can be mapped by the hop map to a point on S2. And different circles, therefore, will map onto different points. Now, you could take a torus in R3, which is which can be represented as a set of circles that are linked to each other and fill the complete torus. And all these circles map, so the whole torus maps to a circle on S2. And if I then take larger tori that go through the initial tori, then all the loops on the second tori will be linked with all the loops on the first tori, but also with all the circles that form the second tori. So you basically get a filling of the whole of space by linked lines. And each line represents a point on S2, or by stereographic projection, it represents a complex number. So in principle, if you have a complex field in R3, you could apply the Hopf map to every complex number. You could associate a circle, and all these circles could be linked. Those are very special complex fields, but they do exist, and again, are characterized by the linking number. So this is a more formal way of representing the Hopf map, where S3 elements in S are transformations of S3 are elements of SU2, and S2 could be taken a unit vector on a sphere. And then if we pick a certain direction, this transformation tells you how a transformation or how elements in S3 map to S2. And you will see that because of this construction, there is a set of elements in S3 that all map to the same point on S2. And that's why circles are mapped to a point. Okay. Now, if you take a specific K vector that defines the specific Hopf map, you could write down the stereographic projection composed with the Hopf map, and that would get you from S3 to the complex plane. You can get this construction. And if you then do the stereographic projection composed with the Hopf map and the stereographic projection two dimensions, you get a map from R3 to C, and that is given by this map. So if you take a complex number here, this is a complex number, you can find a set of x, y, and z points that lie on a circle that fulfill this equation. Yeah, so that's a mathematical formulation of this Hopf map. And the claim is that the electric fields and the magnetic fields in Maxwell's equation exactly map onto these Hopf maps. So we now have to make the link from electromagnetism to these Hopf maps. Yeah? And for that, we have to look at the different notations for Maxwell's equations. So this is the most traditional one. Then we go to Lorentz vectors, so special relative invariant notation. But then in topology and differential geometry, you would use this notation for the set of Maxwell's equations. And I focus on the Maxwell's equations without charges. Yeah. So otherwise, you would have the four current here, but these are zero now. And this is called F is defined as a two form. And D is the exterior derivative on this two form. So F, the two form, is defined in this way. And I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with differential forms. It's a special language that is developed to do calculations on curve manifolds. And differential forms, a one form, can always be locally represented like this. Components dx, and you typically use them in integrals. But if someone is interested in this in more detail, I can explain it after the talk. There's, in the end, there's some basic properties of two forms that we need to use. So I have to go, these are examples of how to use two forms in integration on curve manifolds, just to familiarize yourself. And it also tells you that two forms automatically transforms like volume elements without using extra tricks. So the property that we need is that the exterior derivative of a form, of an n form in an n-dimensional manifold, is automatically zero. And that is quite easy to understand, because let's take an example. If F is a two form, it has two parts here, and this Hodge product it indicates that this is the antisymmetric product of these two. So if I take the exterior derivative, I would add a third element here. I would take the Hodge with that. But if the indices I, j, and k in a two-dimensional manifold can only vary from 1 to 2, at least one of these or two of these indices will be the same, right? So, and if you have two indices the same in an antisymmetric combination of elements, it has to be 0, because you always have minus at the part. Yeah? So df is 0 is a trivial statement on, say, if you are on a two-dimensional manifold, then if you have a two-form, df is automatically 0 on that two form. That's the only point I want to make clear. Yeah? And then if you take twice exterior derivative, if that's 0, then you can always write, if the f is 0, you can always write f as dA, because then d dA is automatically 0, and that gives you the standard form of Maxwell's equations. Okay, that's not, so this is the most important part, that the exterior derivative on a two form in a two-dimensional space is automatically 0. Then another important part is that if you have a two form, if we consider the Hopf map, it's from S3 to S2. If you have a two form on S2, you can pull that back onto a two form in S3. And the properties of the two form in S2 are preserved under the pullback to S3. That's the standard property of differential geometry. And now the argument becomes as follows. We construct solutions of Maxwell's equations by simply taking a two form on a two-dimensional manifold. Yeah? For example, the standard volume two form, dx1, dx2 on S2, and pull it back via the Hopf map to R3, or Minkowski space. And if this map is non-trivial, you get non-trivial solutions of Maxwell's equations. Okay. So the two form that we look at is simply dx dy on a two-dimensional manifold, or on the complex plane. And this is equal to that. So this is the standard way of writing down the most trivial two form on a flat complex plane. Yeah, the eta times the complex d, the complex conjugate. Then you can calculate the two form on S2 that is projected onto C. Remember, you get these factors from the stereographic projection. So this is the most trivial two form on the surface of S2. Okay. Now, because it's a two form on a two-dimensional manifold, df is automatically 0. So there's nothing there. You don't need Maxwell's equations. Df is 0. But if you pull it back to Minkowski space or R3, you still have the f is 0, and then suddenly you start calling it Maxwell's equations. But it's the same thing. So you can pull back this df to four-dimensional space. So you basically take the components with respect to the normal space-time coordinates, and then you get this expression for the two form pulled back in Minkowski space, where the complex numbers are given by this Hopf map, this non-trivial map from S3 to S2 backwards. So by this construction, you automatically have proper solutions of the charge-free Maxwell's equations, but at the same time, you put in the non-trivial topological structure of the Hopf map. So that proves that you get exactly the same structures of the Hopf map in this structure. Yes?
Up to the point that you were mapping into R3, which could be some piece of S3. But how do you get time? I mean, I would think then you would just get pure magnetic fields. is not S3 or S3.
So what I'm focusing here on df is zero, but you need a second set, df star is zero, to get the full Maxwell's equation. So this is half of the story, and you don't get the Maxwell, you don't get just the magnetic field, but you're missing out on important aspects of Maxwell's equations, but they are in df star is zero. And
but if you map and if you fix a moment of time.
Yes, that's what we do.
Make a half map from S3 to R3. Then you end up with a two form, which is in the space. It's just pulled back into the space. So it doesn't have any components in the dt direction. So you should get a pure magnetic field. And it's still a very beautiful construction.
You get you need the full set of equations. You will get by taking the Hopf star, and you do get indeed a snapshot of EB fields at a certain time, and you can then calculate how this evolves as function of time. And in fact, I should just move on. We can make these calculations. We can make simulations. You could start at a certain point.
So you take this as initial data.
That's right. And once you have
Maxwell.
That's right. Okay. So once you have at one point initial data of EMP. That's right. You can extend to poles.
Okay.
And once we realize how to do this, you can actually find a more traditional way of writing down these knots in terms of certain fields, Legendre Gaussian modes that you focus on tightly, and you can actually show that you reproduce these knots of light in the focus of these beams, provided you have a very special spectrum of a frequency spectrum. Otherwise, these structures will not arise. And there's the main experimental problem, that the spectrum is extremely wide. You need to get structures that are of the size of a wave function. So it's not surprising that you need a spectrum that is corresponding to making structures of the size of a wavelength. So you end up in the optics with attosecond laser pulses. Or if you go to the microwave regime, you can work with other techniques. So we actually have a proposal of investigating in which regime these structures are most likely to be produced. Then there are many very interesting extensions to this work. What if you would have a little bit of nonlinearity? Would you get solid-like solutions of this? There's also a link to gravitational fields, because Maxwell's equations have an analogy in the weak field limit to general relativity. So maybe similar structures could apply to space-time. There's a generalization. We have a generalization for higher linking number. The conformal group, the symmetry of these solutions is a conformal symmetry group, which has 15 parameters. And it's not yet clear what these conformal conserved parameters associated to these knots, what they actually represent, what is the physics of these. And another thing is, if we just have the magnetic field lines, which would be a solution as well, then you would get, in a plasma reactor, it's known that the charged particles follow the magnetic field lines, because if they go under an angle, they have more energy, and so if there's some dissipation, in the end, they follow the magnetic field lines. So if you get currents going along a loop, you automatically like to have another B field through that loop. So somehow, this seems to be a natural way in which the plasma would form itself. And we have one line in our paper in that, and we got a response from two nuclear fusion groups that they actually see spontaneous linking of field lines. And the current designs for nuclear fusion reactors, first they were toroidal, and they experimentally find out that it's better to make the ratio more like this, and right now they have spherical nuclear fusion reactors, where they simply let the plasma do what it likes and finds a stable solution. So we think that if you can encourage the plasma to form these knots, then you get a self-stabling effect. So I'm so excited about all the experimental and theoretical parts that I now have a PhD student working on the theory. And we hope to get some funding to start some experiments in this. So I think it's really time to stop. here are some of the images that were associated to the work on cavity QED, the work on towards quantum superposition of a tiny mirror, and works on that supply. Thank you.
Well, on the macroscopic superposition, how far are you from seeing how far you expect to be from seeing a Penrose conjecture? And also, there are those theories that say that the wave function should collapse automatically for maximal objects. You know.
Okay. So there are many. We wouldn't start such an experiment if the only thing we were interested in is doing this macroscopic superposition measurement, because that would be suicidal. So there are quite a few other things that we want to do first before we go to this. Like, there are many questions about what Casimir forces do at the transition of normal to superconducting materials. Those type of measurements, although nobody did them, are orders of magnitude easier than what we really want to do here. So that's what we are planning in the near future. Another experiment we plan is just do the optical cooling starting at a base temperature of maybe 100 microkelvin and see how cold we get. Do we get the quantum ground state of an harmonic oscillator at a few kilohertz? Once all these initial steps have been done, the system is designed to do an experiment that would prove a quantum superposition 8 orders more massive than the largest molecules that have been put in superposition to date. Then we're 4 orders of magnitude away from where Penrose expects something to happen. Yeah. So, but then even Penrose says, well, maybe things already show up much earlier. And the idea of Penrose is very special in the distance dependence, because all the standard decoherence models, they scale with the distance squared, whereas for Penrose, the main part is the first displacement. And what becomes very important is, what is the size of the mass, actually? How is the mass distribution itself? So there is something quite tricky here involved. What do you take as mass distribution of a single atom? So there are discussions that if you would have a crystal, and if you would displace it by one lattice constant, suddenly this displacement, this gravitational-induced decoherence, would be reduced again, because you're more or less back at the same mass distribution. So there are many issues playing. And but before we have an experiment going into that direction, I don't want to spend too much time on breaking my head on such questions.
What's the background of these knots of light for? I missed the name of the person who first proposed these solutions.
Ranjada. R-A-N-A-D-A. And then on the end, there's a little wig.
OK. And that's the paper from 1997 you showed us?
1989 is probably the earliest paper, I think, yes.
OK, so my question is, you said he thought that maybe these solutions could provide an explanation for quantization.
Yes.
And then later decided that that couldn't be done. Can you say more about that? It reminds me a bit of one of Kelvin's ideas to understand particles as vortices. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I mean, many, many great physicists, also Wheeler, spent basically their hobby on trying to derive particles as vortices or link structures of whatever fields. Also, Maxwell himself, he thought of particles as being knots of light. It never crystallized. So Ranjada got sidetracked by an obsession for ball lightning. And he actually moved towards a bit of the plasma physics people. And he's pushing this model that indeed, if you get a few linked lines, you might get a stable plasma configuration, which might describe ball lightning. And he has lengthy articles that calculate the energy and distribution and things. So maybe he's even right in that respect. But he didn't pursue that. He gives the solution, not knowing whether it could be created anyway in an experiment. Could you start with a laser on this table and at the end get such a structure out? You had no idea. He didn't know what spectrum or he just got the mathematical form of one type of solution by using this Hoffman, which is beautiful. Yes?
Yeah, so just a question about that. So in general relativity, I mean, Wheeler and other people studied these solutions, looking for stable kind of solutions of that. David Finkelstein, but they were never stable in general relativity. In electromagnetism, if you use the Maxwell equations, why doesn't it just fall apart?
That's why I showed the evolution. They expand. They don't stay stable. You can create at one moment you make the solution, then they expand, but the linking is preserved, and actually. The velocity it propagates with is not the speed of light. We are confused about that, but it's not a stable configuration.
So you have a linking between electric and magnetic field lines, which is preserved?
It's preserved as function of time. And the pointing vector forms a third configuration that is also forms linked lines. And that structure stays preserved, but the structure does expand. So if there would be any form of nonlinearity, like what happens in a mode of laser where you have a crystal that tries to confine light, that you get pulses. It's not inconceivable that in the medium, if you were to create such a structure in a medium, there could be a stable configuration, just like solitons. But we need a nonlinearity for that. And to describe this, including some nonlinearity, is one of the challenges that this student of mine is working on right now.
Now, you could also have initial data which linked to magnetic field lines with themselves.
Yes.
Do you know anything about those and whether those are stable? Whether those have stable linking lines?
Just the skeleton of magnetic field lines, you say.
I'm
not quite sure if those are proper solutions of the full Maxwell's equation. If they have to propagate this function of time, you automatically get E fields, I'm pretty sure. The question is what happens if you combine it with plasma physics, which is another horrendously nonlinear medium, and I don't dare to say anything there apart from that people see that if you inject helicity in a plasma, it just stabilizes the structure enormously. And if you get linked structures, it just relaxes the structure.
Just a comment. In quantum geometry, there are knots and braids which are topological quantum numbers which are conserved. So the dream is living on in the quantum domain. But it's very surprising to see it in the classical domain.
You mentioned about the connection of ball lightning.
With
ball lightning.
Well, someone asked me what Ranjana is doing, and I said he's working on ball lightning, and he said it might not be completely crazy, yes.
So I thought that there were experiments recently that were done that seemed to generate ball lightning.
I have not studied that topic.